Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour, bringing you our weekly reflection on the Sunday Gospel and a look back at the Vatican Week with Joan Lewis. Thanks so much for joining me once again. Let's begin, as always, at this time of week by joining Jill Bevilacqua for her personal reflection on this Sunday's Gospel by the intriguing title of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye.
The Sisters of Lazarus sent word to Jesus to inform him, "Lord, the one you love is sick." Upon hearing this, Jesus said, "This sickness is not to end in death. Rather, it is for God's glory, that through it the Son of God may be glorified." Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus very much. Yet, after hearing that Lazarus was sick, he stayed on where he was for 2 days more. Finally, he said to his disciples, "Let us go back to Judea." When Jesus arrived at Bethany, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went to meet him while Mary sat at home. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would never have died. Even now I'm sure that God will give you whatever you ask of him." "Your brother will rise again," Jesus assured her. "I know he will rise again," Martha replied, "in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus told her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he should die, will come to life, and whoever is alive and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?"
"Yes, Lord," she replied.
"I have come to believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, he who is to come into the world." Jesus was troubled in spirit, moved by the deepest emotions. "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Lord, come and see," they said. Jesus began to weep, which caused the Jews to remark, "See how much he loved him." But some said, "He opened the eyes of that blind man. Why could he not have done something to stop this man from dying?" Once again, troubled in spirit, Jesus approached the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across it. "Take away the stone," Jesus directed. Martha, the dead man's sister, said to him, "Lord, it's been 4 days now. Surely there will be a stench." Jesus replied, "Did I not assure you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" They then took away the stone, and Jesus looked upward and said, "Father, I thank you for having heard me. I know that you always hear me. But I have said this for the sake of the crowd, that they may believe that you sent me." Having said this, he called loudly, "Lazarus, come out." The dead man came out, bound hand and foot with linen strips, his face wrapped in a cloth. "Untie him," Jesus told them, "and let him go free." This caused many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did to put their faith in him.
At a time when email and even telegrams were centuries away in the future, two sisters sent a telegraphic message to Jesus of 7 words. "Lord, the one you love is sick." There was no need to elaborate. He would understand immediately. And this brief message, which led to this last great miracle before his passion, brings to mind those 4 words spoken by his mother, leading to his first miracle in Cana, "They have no wine." But before we even consider the miracle of the raising of the brother of Martha and Mary, our natural curiosity pushes to the fore all kinds of questions. Who were they, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, the brother who only appears as a resurrected body and as a guest at a dinner? We don't know anything about him, Was he tall or short, thin or fat, dull or witty? What was his relationship with his sisters? And a fairly obvious question, what did he die of? One thing we do know, though, our Lord loved him, which should be enough for us. The evangelist certainly thinks so. As for Mary and Martha, we've already met them, and their personalities are clearly etched in Luke's account, where Martha is distracted with much serving, while Mary sits at our Lord's feet. Still, one would like to know something more about this family. Are they all about our Lord's age? 30-ish? Is Martha perhaps the eldest, and was she ever married? Mary we're never sure of. Was she Magdalene? We know she anointed the feet of Jesus at the house of Simon the leper, also in Bethany, where Martha again is serving, and Lazarus, raised from the dead, is one of the guests. Certainly, Jesus was very close to this little family, and it is to their house that he goes most often, as if it were a second home. There's a description by travel writer H.V. Morton of the view from the Mount of Olives, which must have been very familiar to Jesus as he went back and forth between Jerusalem and his friend's house in Bethany.
The Mount of Olives is slightly higher than Jerusalem and stands up, therefore, like a screen between the city and the desert land that falls to the Dead Sea. From the top of the Mount of Olives, the view looked like a photograph of the mountains of the moon, an apparently sterile world of brown, domed hills piled together, bare of vegetation, and falling rapidly into the hot distance, where a streak of blue marked the waters of the Dead Sea. Beyond the blueness rose a barrier of brown hills streaked with violet shadows. They were the mountains of Moab. This was a view that Jesus knew well, and it's not altered since his eyes gazed upon it. He saw it when he came over the hill from Bethany. The golden age of Israel was in the desert, and I wondered as I looked down on the silent, dead hills whether Jesus loved to sleep in Bethany because, after the wrangling in the temple court, he could catch a glimpse, as he crossed the Mount of Olives on his way back in the evening, of the calm, desert place, dedicated forever to God.
And Bethany, a village about 2 miles east of Jerusalem, described by Morton, writing in the 1930s, as a little Arab village on a slight hill, a huddle of houses that looked like ruins, and ruins that looked like houses. And this huddle, he goes on, stands on the spot which Jesus knew as Bethany, the home of dates. There's no doubt at all that this is Bethany. But although tourist guides may point out Mary and Martha's house, as our writer comments, it cannot possibly be authentic. All one can say is that somewhere on the hill is the house in which Martha, Mary, and their brother Lazarus lived. Incidentally, the modern Arabic name for Bethany is El Azareh, a form of Lazarus or Eleazar, a very common name at that time, meaning in Hebrew, God helps. And so to our miracle, and to an unusual interpretation of the feelings and thoughts of our Lord on this occasion. Here is The Raising of Lazarus, written by German poet Rainer Maria Rilke in the early 20th century.
One had to bear with the majority. What they wanted was a sign that screamed. Martha, though, and Mary, he had dreamed they would be contented just to see that he could. But not a soul believed him. "Lord, you've come too late," said all the crowd. So to peaceful nature, though it grieved him, on he went to do the unallowed. Asked them, eyes half shut, his body glowing with anger, "Where's the grave?" Tormentedly. And to them it seemed his tears were flowing, as they thronged behind him curiously. As he walked, The thing seemed monstrous to him, childish, horrible experiment. Then there suddenly went flaming through him such an all-consuming argument against their life, their death, their whole collection of separations made by them alone. All his body quivered with rejection as he gave out hoarsely, "Raise the stone." Someone shouted that the corpse was stinking, buried now 4 days ago. But he stood erect, brimful of that unblinking, mounting gesture that so painfully lifted up his hand. No hand was ever raised so slowly, so immeasurably, till it stood there, shining in the gloom. There it slowly, clawingly contracted. What if all the dead should be attracted upwards, through that siphon of a tomb, where a pallid, chrysalid thing was writhing up from where it had been lying? But it stood alone, no more replying, and they saw vague, unidentifying life, compelled to give it harbouring.
From this very individual impression to a comment by Sheed, "Nothing is stranger in the story of the raising of Lazarus," he writes, "than Jesus' own reactions, his weeping and distress, his sighing and groaning." But his tears could have been prompted at the sight of Mary weeping and the knowledge that Martha too was grieving in her own way, while he himself had lost a dear friend. But we're also told, more than once, that he was troubled in spirit, moved by the deepest emotions. What were they, these emotions? "There seems no doubt," writes Sheed, "that he was praying to his Father for the power this miracle of all miracles needed. For when it was on the point of happening, he said, 'Father, I give thee thanks that thou hast heard me.'" We might wish now to take a look at the tomb where Lazarus had lain for 4 long days. But that surely is to miss the point. He has returned to life. And so let's listen to the voice of the protagonist himself, in the words of a contemporary poet, Peter Redgrove. Here now is an extract from Lazarus and the Sea.
I could say nothing of where I had been, but I knew the soil in my limbs and the rainwater in my mouth, knew the ground as a slow sea, unstable like clouds and tolerating no organization such as mine in its throat of my grave. The knotted roots would have entered my nostrils and held me by the armpits, woven a blanket for my cold body, dead in the smell of wet earth, and raised me to the sky for the sun in the slow dance of the seasons. Many gods like me would be laid in the ground, dissolve and be formed again in this pure night among the blessing of birds and the sifting water. But where was the boatman and his gliding punt, the judgment and the flames? These happenings were much spoken of in my childhood and the legends. And what judgment tore me to life, uprooted me back to my old problems and to the family, charged me with unfitness for this holy simplicity?
The thoughts and feelings of Lazarus on returning to life can only be imagined, but there's nothing fanciful in the stupendous dialogue between Jesus and Martha, which took place before the miracle and which is on record for all time. H.V. Morton exclaims admiringly,
"How marvellously St. John takes up the brush and fills in little details of this character study. 'Lord,' began Martha in her usual blunt way, 'if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died.' Then, revealing the real depths of her soul, she says, 'But I know that even now, whatsoever thou wilt ask of God, God will give it thee.' And it was to this depth of faith in Martha that Jesus spoke those words that have brought comfort and hope wherever a man or a woman has stood above an open grave. I am the resurrection and the life, he said to Martha.
Many thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for her inspiring weekly reflection on the Sunday Gospel. And now why not join Joan Lewis as she takes a look for us at some of the appointments on Pope Benedict XVI's schedule this past week. Joan, welcome back.
It is good to be back, and I want to tell you, the weather is just so...
Summer. Yeah.
Yes, today
should
is...
Should be spring, but it's summer.
In a word, it's glorious. It really, really is.
And Pope Benedict mentioned John Paul II on Sunday, didn't he, at the Angelus?
He did. He, at the end of Reflections on the Gospel of the Day, which is the ordinary part of his Angelus greetings, he recalled that the day earlier, Saturday, April 2nd, was the 6th anniversary of the death of John Paul. And the Pope said, due to his forthcoming beatification, I did not celebrate the Mass for the repose of his soul, but remembered him with affection in prayer, and he added, as I think all of you have done. And the Pope said, along the Lenten path as we prepare for Easter, we also approach with joy the day on which we will be able to venerate as blessed this great pontiff and witness of Christ and trust evermore in his intercession.
Then during the week, there was a press conference at the Vatican Press Office, of course.
Exactly.
Releasing the plans for this beatification, because there's all kinds of projects connected
Amazing.
To the beatification.
3 days of events. Obviously, the focal point is the Sunday, May 1st beatification of John Paul. And this is one of the longest press conferences I've ever attended. It was just a tad under 2 hours. And you had Father Lombardi from the Vatican. You had Cardinal Valli, who is the vicar for the Diocese of Rome. You had Father Cesare Attuiri, who heads Opera Romana Pellegrinaggi, and he talked about the logistical aspects of the beatification, people staying there, creating tent cities for young people near the port city of Civitavecchia, near the airport town of Fiumicino, and so forth. And then there was a priest, Father Insero, I think was his name, Walter Insero, heads the communications office for the Vicariate of Rome. And, the facts and figures and program released is really amazing. We are at really more or less, obviously, in a nutshell, you know, we have a few minutes and this took 2 hours to do. So nutshells are important. The first of the 3 days of ceremonies will be the vigil in the Circus Maximus on Saturday night, April 30th.
Which is the other side of the Tiber, for those who are not familiar with Rome.
Yes, part of ancient Rome. Anybody who has seen a lot of movies about ancient Rome, some were filmed in or near the circus. But the first part evening will feature two people that you and I know well, met in the past, and that is to say now Cardinal Stanislaw Żywiec, who was the Pope's secretary for 40 years, and Joaquin Navarro Valls, who for more than 20 years, I think it was 22, headed the Holy See Press Office. They will give a testimony, as will Sister Marie-Simone Pierre, the French nun, I believe she's 49, whose miraculous cure from Parkinson's, very shortly actually after the death of John Paul, is attributed to his intercession. She and her entire order had this novena going to the Holy Father, and she was cured of that. So we will have that witnessing. And then the second part of this vigil will focus on the luminous mysteries of the Rosary, which, of course, Pope John Paul himself introduced to the world in October 2002. And there will be a hymn, Open the Doors to Christ. We got copies of that last week in Italian. I'm hoping it's going to be in other languages. And Cardinal Valini will summarize the spiritual and pastoral character of John Paul II, and the rosary, this is interesting, the rosary will be recited with a live connection to 5 Marian shrines around the world, and each of the 5 mysteries of the rosary will be linked to a prayer intention. So we have the shrine of, I always kind of mess this up, Wagenicki. Thank you very much. Okay.
In Krakow, right. Yeah.
And the prayer intention will be the theme of youth. And then in a shrine in Tanzania, Kawakamo, the family is the intention. Our Lady of Lebanon, Harissa Lebanon, evangelization. Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe, Mexico City, hope and peace among peoples. And lastly, but not leastly at all, the shrine of Fatima for the church. And what is even more interesting in this link-up is the fact with these basilicas, at the end of this vigil, which promises to be very, very beautiful and suggestivo, as we say in Italian, there are eight Roman churches. I won't name them right now, and they're on various websites. There are eight Roman churches that will remain open all night for prayer. And these churches are between the Circus Maximus and the Vatican. So as you wend your way to the Vatican, for anybody who will be up all night, those possibilities will be there. And it was suggested
Church of the Modern Martyrs among them, which is unusual, on the Tiber Island.
Well, thank there are so many modern martyrs. We seem to speak of them, certainly in this show. And it was suggested that security, we don't have it from them yet, but that Vatican security will probably open the square for people to enter about 5 in the morning. That was an hour that was mentioned. They know the crowd's going to be huge.
And no invitations are needed.
No invitations are needed. However, there's a huge number of new security machines. And I'm guessing there's at least a dozen or more new ones. There's probably a dozen on each side of the colonnade. So I think that's certainly to enable the larger crowds for this event and in the future to come in a lot faster. Now, of course, that's Saturday, a very important vigil. Sunday, obviously, we have the Mass in which the John Paul will become blessed. And they mentioned, I'm sure our listeners know, that a tapestry is always hung from the main loggia, if it's only one person, in the St. Peter's Square. And they were asked the other day at the press conference what image of John Paul was going to be used, and they said we would have to wait until that day. So I'm sure there's people out there trying to find out what image it is and make someone slip up in a conversation. But apparently we will have to wait. And then after the Mass, the Pope's body will, the casket, the wood casket in which he lies, there's one of three, that is going to be brought from its current resting place in the grottoes of the Basilica to just in front of the tomb of St. Peter. And that's going to happen on April 29th, the night of April 29th, after the Basilica closes. That's Friday. The body of Blessed Pope Innocent the 11th, which is at the altar of St. Sebastian as we speak, that will be moved to the altar of the Transfiguration to make room then in the next day for John Paul's for John Paul's body to be his casket, because the body will not be seen. That was quite clear. Just the casket will be there for viewing. However, the casket's actually going to be for a while in front of the main altar, the papal altar, in the Vatican Basilica. And after the Mass of Beatification on Sunday, the cardinals will process in with the Holy Father to pay homage to the late pontiff and the new blessed. And then about an hour or so after they will have left the Basilica, half an hour to an hour, the doors will reopen for the public, and they will be allowed to go in. And if need be, it was said the other day, the Basilica will remain open all night for people to be able to flow in and pay their homage to Blessed John Paul. And it would only close probably, as it did when people were viewing him after he died, it will probably only close the Basilica from 2 to 3 in the morning. Then the next day, Monday, of course, is the Mass of Thanksgiving celebrated by Cardinal Secretary of State Tarcisio Bertone. That's in St. Peter's Square. And that will be then by that time, the Basilica, before that Mass begins, the Basilica will have been closed for viewing. Will the casket, I think this is a point that isn't too clear yet, will the casket be available for viewing after the Monday Mass? Because they are expecting huge numbers of people, although the Vatican on Tuesday, the figure that came out was like 300,000, which is very much below what the city and others are estimating from hotel occupancy, the flights of people coming in. I can't tell you, the numbers coming in from Poland that I've heard already go well beyond 300,000. Mm-hmm. So it'll be very, very interesting. But as Father Atuire said, if there's 300 or 400,000, let's say 300,000 at the vigil, and then the next day there's 300,000 at the Mass, are they all the same people? Are some of them the same people? So counting can be difficult. But it does promise to be a massive event.
An historic event. Maybe.
Yes, historic. And you know, I was doing the math the other day. I cannot be the first person to have thought of this. But Pope Benedict, in a few days, turns 84. And he will be beatifying his predecessor, who was 84 when he died. And he was just a month, as we know, a little more than a month short of his 85th birthday. So a very, very interesting fact, I think, as far as that goes.
So, Joan, this was a joyful event. Moving on Wednesday, the dramatic moment in the audience.
Absolutely. Several of them, to be honest. The audience, the catechesis was St. Thérèse of Lisieux, but at the end of the audience, the Pope appealed for an end to the fighting in Libya and the Ivory Coast and asked for the beginning of dialogue to avoid further bloodshed. And he said very, very strongly, violence and hatred are always a defeat. He said he was following all these events with great apprehension. And amazingly enough, he said he hoped that his envoy to the Ivory Coast, Cardinal Turkson, has not been able to enter the country. Or he wasn't anyway as of Wednesday. And as we speak, I don't know if that's changed. But interestingly enough, also at the end of the Wednesday audience, when the Holy Father normally receives guests and bishops and so forth, he received Paul Bhatti, the brother of the slain Pakistani Catholic member of Parliament, Shahbaz Bhatti. And he asked the Pope to continue to support the commitment of Pakistani Christians for the respect for their rights. Now, there was also an imam with him who was a very, very close friend of his brothers, and both the imam and Shahbaz Bhatti had been collaborating together for justice and peace and certainly interreligious dialogue. And then later on, there was a group that met the Holy Father, two representatives, 16 students, Hebrew and Palestinian, from various universities in Jerusalem. And two of them, a Jewish boy and a Muslim girl, were able to meet the Holy Father and greet him on behalf of their delegation. So a very moving morning, I'm sure, for the Holy Father.
So we've got some exciting weeks ahead of us. We've got Holy Week.
Oh, we do. An amazing, amazing period. And I'm sure that as time goes on, most of the questions asked by the journalist at the press conference Tuesday were answered. There were some details still to be worked out regarding the beatification. And bit by bit, as they come out, we will bring those to our listeners.
Well, thank you very much, Joan.
Well, we'll see you the next time.
A big thank you there to Joan Lewis. She'll be back again at this same time next week. And that brings me up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. So do join us then. Meanwhile, should you wish to write to us, our email address is english@vatiradio.va. Otherwise, drop us a line by snail mail. The address is English Programme, Vatican Radio, Vatican City. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.